Return to Northmoor, episode 12. Running time, 38 minutes. And this is Tim.
Welcome to the Return to Northmoor podcast.
We're going to be changing the format of Tish this week, and we hope you like it.
If you do, please leave us a comment on our forums. If you don't, please leave us a comment on our forums. Those forums can be found at spookyouthouse.com.
This week, we're going to be discussing the dungeon, the Temple of Art. But before we get into the discussion of our dungeon, we just thought we'd discuss a few of our favorite dungeons from times past.
So, Tim, what is your favorite dungeon?
Well, in terms of ones I've bought from other people, I think my favorite is probably the Ravenloft module.
Yeah, really?
It's definitely dungeon-y. It's got a nice 3D isometric map.
Even though it's not really underground so much.
But it was definitely a dungeon crawl. You went from room to room watching Strahd's minions tear your minds apart.
Delightful.
Yes. But in terms of ones really from my past, I'd say there was a couple that I've made over the years that I was particularly attached to. One I made in high school, and it was my very first thing I ever ran at a con ever. And at the end of it, I said, "What did you think of my adventure?" And the older gentlemen who were there with me said, "Well, it was a very nice dungeon." And I think that's when I first realized that while dungeons are fun and very cool, they can be an important part of an adventure, but they can't be the entire adventure. And then later in college, I built several that I was pretty happy with, but I always hearken back to that Ravenloft and just how cool it was that every part of the thing was connected to the story as well as being just a room with something in it.
See, I have to go back to the ultimate old school dungeon. The Temple of Elemental Evil.
Yeah, there was some pretty cool stuff in there, and it was truly huge.
It was truly huge. My ex-husband ran me through a number of them on a number of different adventures. Usually kicked our butts.
Yeah, what was your favorite moment from being butt-kicked?
Well, I think my very favorite moment was a room with Will-O-Wisp when, due to storylines and artifacts that we had picked up at one point or the other, I end up having to kill most of the party to save them.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, you tend to like it when you get turned against the rest of the party.
I don't really like it. It just happens to me.
Yeah, it hasn't happened so much these days.
Not recently, no. And I really appreciate that, actually, because after that one, I didn't speak to one of the people in the group for 2 years.
Yeah.
I think he kind of held it against me.
Could be. He was sort of a known chicken, though.
Yeah, he was.
So what about other moments that you've enjoyed?
Well, I think one of my favorite moments was actually not the dungeon crawl itself, but the entrance to the dungeon. And again, my ex-husband, who ran a number of games during my college years, had created this mountain type of dungeon crawl where the entrance was guarded by an ancient red dragon, but it also had a null magic field around it. And so you were mano a mano with a very large reptilian creature. He didn't have any magic, and neither did we.
Yes, back in the old days of second edition, when instead of actually fixing the game, we would just add new weird things to it, like dead magic zones and disenchanters and that sort of thing.
Hey, it worked for the time.
Yes, the pendulum swings. So what's the best part about having a dungeon night for your adventure as opposed to sort of a normal gaming night?
Well, I think that it really kind of makes you focus on what you're doing. It gives an opportunity to those who really enjoy combat and mapping and the adventure rather than role-playing to come to the forefront.
Well, as a DM, it's nice because everything's laid out ahead of time and all you do is basically have to unspool it. You build your obstacle course, and even though the group may have multiple paths that they can take, you've already figured out what all those paths are, and so it's just a matter of reacting to where they go, as opposed to outside the dungeon when really anything goes.
But we don't do that to you very often.
Anyway, the thing that I really like about the dungeon we're going to describe for you tonight is that it's different than your typical musty, dusty, underground, nasty place.
Absolutely. This dungeon happens to be very clean, and that while not well lit, there is some lighting around.
We've sort of described it as analogous to the emergency lighting you might have in a building when the power's out.
You kind of can think of this entire dungeon as what you would experience if you went into a large mega mall and nobody was there.
Don't be confused that this is any sort of modern setting. I mean, this is definitely an ancient Romanesque sort of building. These people had magic, and they imbued many of their buildings with that magic. And the civilization, while 1,000 years dead, these buildings have been sealed in time and only opened a week ago. Or at least this one was only opened a week ago. So as a result, it's almost like it's only a week without people in it.
And it doesn't have that creepy, scary vibe to it. It has more of that, what's going on, where are all the people vibe.
again, analogous to the if someone shut down the mall and you were walking through it with no one around, where is everyone? It's almost more of a post-apocalyptic vibe than it is a fantasy dungeon vibe.
And most of the rooms in this dungeon are quite large as well.
Especially compared to your typical sort of 5x5 room or 20x20 room dungeon.
And while underground, it is all finished. There's no rough cave-like surfaces or anything like that.
And rather than being gray stone like your typical castle sort of dungeon, it's opaline marble. So opaline, remember that opalescent feel that opals have, which is almost like an oil slick on top of a stone, sparkly but still smooth. Imagine a whole building made of marble that had that sort of sheen, but with even more vividly colored streaks running through it.
So just think of it as something like a really subtle sunrise or sunset with those colors all within the stone.
So very classy, not garish, but at the same time, much more fantasy than your typical white marble with blue streaks.
So I guess with that, we can get into the dungeon.
Again, they're entering the Temple of Art, and this was a art museum, if you will, for the ancient Belloquin civilization, but with a very heavily religious twist. This temple was dedicated to Corallon. Corallon, in 4th edition, is both the god of the elves and the Eladrin, but also the god of art and beauty. As a result, it's a very reverent feel to the entire thing. It's the worship of art and beauty, more than just showing off some objects.
And when the creators of this temple had people go into it, they wanted them to be clear-minded and focused on the art that was held within, rather than all of the everyday problems that people might have.
And this place really retains a lot of that. It's pretty much in pristine condition. We'll describe a few places where the chaos cult that overthrew the entire Belloquin civilization did some damage, and we'll also discuss some of the detritus that the Sahuagin have left as they've entered deeper into the complex. But in general, this is pretty much, sans people, exactly how it was left 1,000 years ago.
So the first thing that your characters will find is this hall of entry, which is right on the other side of the door from the column room that we described in our last episode.
If you remember, there's those 4 carotided columns, and just beyond them is a big door. Once you go through that door, there's a little vestibule, and the party can kind of stage themselves, maybe do some healing searches, relax a little bit. But from that vestibule, entering deeper, is what we call the calming passage. And the calming passage is a way to calm entrance into the temple down and make them more perceptive and intuitive toward the art they're about to experience.
So your character is going to see that it is a bluish-green, very calming colors of a hallway.
And it's tiled. It's an arched roof hallway. It's semicircular all the way down.
Now, if your characters are kind of spooked and paranoid by this, they will be offered a chance to look around and find a control panel that is hidden within the walls.
And if your group is like, let's go in, let's check it out, in we go, we want to rescue our mentor, then just let them go through. And there are some effects that we'll describe in a second that happen to them as they go through the passage. If they're a little more paranoid than that and are wondering about this long bluish-green tunnel whose colors subtly shift, and we've also listed some other things they might notice with various perception checks, then you can actually have them disarm this passage. And we've actually described this passage fully as a hazard in 4E terms, so that they can do countermeasures against it by disarming the panel. They can also destroy the control panel, or they can just try to run through it really fast. And we've given all the stats on how to do that in the write-up.
So once your characters make a decision as to how they're going to go about this, you can let them know that they are going to be very calm, and they are going to have the effects of a daze. But on the other hand, they're going to be very perceptive, because that was the original intent of the creators.
Well, they'll be dazed until they make a save, which hopefully will be a few seconds after exiting the passage. However, they will have +2 to their insight and perception until their next extended rest, that is, the next time they sleep.
Which, of course, is a very important thing if you're checking out art.
Right. So hopefully they've made it through the passage, they've calmed down, they're more perceptive, they're ready to go, and they enter our next room, which is the big entry hall, which we call
the Grand Foyer.
The Grand Foyer. The Grand Foyer is a very large room, and it is 20 feet-ish high, and the lighting in here is pretty dim, but as they enter, they're going to notice one of the strange effects of the temple, which is this light that sort of follows them around.
And as they advance, or as each individual character advances, there is somewhat of a spotlight effect around each of them.
Right. It's not exactly like the tiles light up under them Michael Jackson style, but it's really more like just a little spotlight from nowhere is lighting up them and the area around them. The idea, again, to enhance the colors and the beauty of the art in their direct vicinity.
So once your characters enter this very, very large room, they're going to notice that there's a lot of art around. there is one incredibly stunning piece that they will notice right away, which is a crystal sculpture.
The reason they'll notice it is because even though this room isn't very well lit, again, think of that emergency lighting, they can just sort of see into the dim corners of the room. The sculpture itself is glowing. It is a carved piece of crystal, a single piece of crystal, that stretches from the floor to the ceiling. It's somewhere between 15 and 20 feet wide, depending on the piece of it. And it is a beautiful, delicately carved, columnar structure. And in some places, the strands of the carving are thick and strong and almost faceted like a gem. In other places, they are smooth and almost thread-like as they weave and intertwine amongst each other. The sculpture itself does glow, and it is casting off tiny little sparkettes, almost like energy is cascading off the surface of it. It's almost hypnotic to look at, and if someone stares at it long enough, they could become captivated with its beauty.
On either side of the crystalline structure are two curving staircases that lead to the second floor of this building.
And those are the exits from this room. Now let's pause for a moment and discuss what we can and can't do in the format of this podcast. What we can do is eventually describe all of the rooms in this dungeon. What we can't do is do them all at once. So what we're going to do is we're going to follow along the path that our group took when we went through this and break that up into different podcasts according to the nights of play that it took us to do it. Eventually, we'll cover all of the rooms. In this case, we're going to take the left-hand staircase up and follow that along. And I'll explain why in just a minute.
So other things that they see in this grand foyer room are a number of great pieces of art. And as the characters look around, they're going to notice a number of things. Particularly, the characters are going to see a structure that is repeated through a number of the pieces of art. And that is this rounded-off, boulder-strewn black pyramid. And that is the Star Temple, which is one of the central parts of this entire adventure.
So imagine a Mayan-style squared-off top temple, but made of hundreds of huge obsidian boulders stacked on top of each other, sharp and jagged, and not at all fitting in with this opalescent architecture that makes up the city of Belalaqua. The Star Temple is placed pretty much in the center of the city, almost as if they built the city around it. Hint, they did. The city as it wraps around it really just doesn't seem to fit in at all with that Star Temple, but almost every painting seems to feature it in some way, shape, or form.
It can either be out in the distance of a landscape, it can be a central figure with marketplaces in front of it. There's a lot of ways that you can feature it in these works of art. Now, your characters are going to probably notice this, and they're going to probably ask what the heck it is. And so you as a GM are going to ask them to make arcana rolls or history rolls of some sort or another.
In addition, because Renar did describe it back in Session 3 during the Ranger's Tale of Star Temple section, he will have described it pretty well, so they should recognize what he was talking about from there. Now, this isn't the same Star Temple he and his group went through, but this is one of the five total that exist.
Another thing that your characters are going to notice are interesting pieces of their past. Whether they're pieces of jewelry that have been handed down through the ages, they might be faces that are familiar, there might be scenes that they have heard of in tales that were told around campfires or around the dinner table.
Now you have two choices here. My recommendation is that you use the technique that Doyce described back in our meta episode about blending story games in D&D. Have the character come up to one of these pieces of art and say, "Now that you realize that your heritage lies with the people who built this city. Things feel familiar. Coming into this temple's almost like coming home. What is it that you see in this painting or in this vase or whatever that reminds you of your heritage?"
And your character should be able to pick up that story based on their backgrounds. And so this is a collaboration in the story between you and your players.
Exactly. The idea to tie them together with what's going on here. And this is what makes this dungeon unique and personalized to not only Return to Northmoor, but to your game. That said, if you're running this externally, if you're not running this dungeon as part of Return to Northmoor, you could have all kinds of other stuff in this painting that maybe hook into other parts of your campaign.
Absolutely, because a lot of the things that we describe in Return to Northmoor are chunks that you can utilize for your own campaign as features or vignettes.
One thing that is true of this art is that it is all from different worlds. There's a lot of this art that is from the Feywild, and the whole Fey influence pervades the temple. Again, this is a temple to Corallon. Many of the vignettes that you'll see in these paintings are of other worlds, of other places, of things that the characters may or may not recognize, demons, devils, the astral plane,
etc. And the link to the Feywild is pretty apparent from the very beginning when they start to enter it, with a Kumaat being outside of it as somewhat of a guardian that was either lured or attracted to the area because of that essential bond.
So if you don't feel comfortable having your players contribute to what they see, or maybe some do and some don't, then feel free to describe it for them. For example, they see the necklace handed down from their grandmother or other things as Kim described. Since all of the characters have uncertain parentage, if you used our basic background, this is a chance for them to start to connect with their past in a way that they may not have been able to do before. So this is the room of the dungeon that has the most opportunity to provoke that sort of role-playing. So play it up.
Now, another thing that we need to mention about this temple is that the time frame is about 500 years to 1,000 years into the past is when it originated. So even if you have some long-lived races in there, they might see images of their mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, or grandparents. So it could be very close to them, despite its age.
So if you have an Eladrin character, they could see themselves as a child, for example, even in some of these paintings.
You can really play with that when it comes to getting your characters to think about their past and having a really great role-playing moment.
In general, we don't recommend you let the characters take stuff out of here. Again, emphasize that shrine feel. But if they feel the need to, they can grab enough trinkets to make up a level 2 treasure parcel.
So moving on up the left-hand side of the staircase, the characters are going to be moving into the Hall of Nature.
So why would they come in here? Well, my suggestion is to have some noises come from this direction of the hallway. Also, they might find a few little chunks of Sahuagin scales or something like that that indicates the Sahuagin maybe came this way. Since they're in here looking for their mentor, that should lead them down this particular direction.
As a reminder, they're not sure where their mentor lies within this great, big, huge temple. So they're going to have the reason to search as many of the rooms as they possibly can.
If you look at the map that's provided in the materials, it would seem pretty obvious to you that they want to just get through from start to finish as quickly as possible to get to where their mentor is. The PCs aren't going to know which door in this place their mentor is behind.
And there are a number of concealed doors that they're not sure of, and he could be anywhere.
Let's go ahead and talk about this Hall of Nature. There are two main halls. The left one, which we're exploring now, is the Hall of Nature. The right one, which we'll cover in a future episode, is the Hall of People. This one is dedicated to art that features nature. The walls are paneled in a rich colored wood, and upon closer inspection, perception checks, the characters can determine that the wood actually was from trees felled by lightning. There's burned streaks running through it that have been artfully worked into the design.
And in this hallway, there are a number of additional works of art. There's landscapes, animals, there's a number of carvings from shells, from wood, from bone. So there's a lot of natural kind of art here.
This is a very long hallway, a very wide hallway. There's art lining both sides of it. Again, it's very dimly lit, just so that emergency lighting. So it might not even be possible to see the end of the hallway. One of the things they're going to notice, probably the first thing they're going to notice, is that there's some sound, definitely some smell, coming from behind one of the paintings on the right side of the hallway.
They will also notice that some of the works of art and some of the walls, some of the statues within this hallway have been vandalized.
This is the work of that chaos cult, who came in through a workshop, which is through another secret door that's in this hallway, came out of that workshop, they were carried in with crates. They broke out of the crates, they came into this hallway, and they started trashing the place, and then they basically broke into the guard room, which is where we're going to be going next, and killed off all the guards, and that's when their temple was sealed, and that's where it was pretty much left in the temple's terms about a week ago.
As the characters are moving on through this hallway, they should have really a sense of how pristine and how museum-like this entire building really is. And imagine the shock you would have when you come upon these works of glorious art that have been vandalized, ripped apart, blood sprayed on them, figurines shattered to the ground. One of the most important things for them to see is a very large painting that has "Chaos shall free us from the shackles of Arathis's order." So that's going to be scrawled across this painting in bright red livid paint or blood.
And this is really a desecration. This place is a temple. As much as we describe it like a museum, remember, it's a temple. It's truly as though this place was desecrated by these chaos cultists. The painting that Kim just described with the writing on it is also the painting from which the smell is emerging.
The smell that they are sensing is that sickly sweet smell of decaying flesh. there's something not quite right beyond that entry. Now, they're not entirely sure how they can get beyond it, and so they're going to need to search around.
So with some perception checks on the painting, they will determine that one of the stars in this painting, and the painting is of a landscape, a field of amber grain with purple mountains in the background, but the majority of the painting is actually made up by a star field above, a night sky with twinkling stars that almost seem to be twinkling. Well, one of them is actually a small gemstone that, when pressed, will cause the painting to swing open and reveal a passage beyond.
If the characters explore more of this room, they're going to find, somewhere in the middle of it, a multicolored cloak that has been discarded. And it will be bloodstained, but there will be no body associated with it.
And this multicolored cloak matches the descriptions that the guards gave in our last episode of what the Chaos Cultists were wearing when they attacked.
So that might put them on guard and perhaps alert them that there might be some danger coming up.
They're walking down this hall. They get sort of a strange smell. They see the damage from this Chaos Cultists. They see this multicolored cloak lying in the center of the floor, perhaps directly in front of this painting. If you need to lure them closer to the painting, again, sounds can be coming from behind it. So, they've opened the painting, hopefully by pressing that star button, if you will. The painting has swung open. There was a very long hall leading off to distance. It's a very narrow hall. This is the narrowest hall that they've seen so far. It leads off towards the guard room.
As they enter this hallway, there's going to be the same kind of ambient light, and you need to wait until all of the characters are within this hallway before the door closes.
So the door closed behind them as they enter. Halfway down this hall, there's an invisible dead body. It's one of these Chaos Cultists. It's completely invisible. He had invisibility cast on him or took an invisibility potion or some other weird chaos magic that made him invisible before they attacked. And he unfortunately died halfway through. He's laying in the middle of the floor. So the idea of this encounter is this. The advance guard of the group is coming down this hall, heading down toward what appears to be a different sort of room. No more art. This hallway is very plain. And trips over a dead body.
So they're going to take a little bit of time to discover if this is a rock or some kind of obstacle. And as they kind of feel it up, they're going to realize that this is the body and probably where the smell is really coming from.
So here's the best part. This Chaos Cultist was carrying a Slod Tadpole in his head. Go look it up, what a Slod is. They're going to be featured in just a second. They are chaotic elementals that are sort of frog-like. And their MO is they implant their tadpoles in people's heads that later burst out.
So this is what has happened to this Chaos Cultist. And you can come up with a lot of scenarios. Personally, my scenario is that he was deemed as chosen and had this implanted willingly.
Yes.
And it was an inopportune time for it to kind of burst out of him.
So here's the fun part of this encounter. They're sneaking down the hall. They trip over this invisible dead body. They reach down to try to figure out what it is. Now, depending on who it is that trips, maybe they have experience tripping over dead bodies in the dark. Maybe they don't. But they start feeling around to try to feel what it is, and they get to where the head is, and the entire back of the head has exploded out as this tadpole is there. So they're putting their hands in this, like, exploded back of the head that's in this dead body. It's really grisly and exciting.
And I can't imagine that because this body is invisible, they're going to actually see the gore on their hands when they remove it. So all they're going to know is it's this really smelly, gooey, kind of crunchy sensation. And if you have a cleric or a healer, of course they're going to kind of have an idea of what's going on and try to get that off of them. Now, this is very distracting. I can imagine one or two of the characters kind of kneeling down, patting this body down, and the rest of them are hovering over, you know, kind of anxious. And then we have another attack.
So ideally, as someone is trying to wipe invisible blood off their hands on their pants, and by the way, if you think that the blood should be not invisible or something, come to our forums and tell us why. They're wiping this invisible blood on their pants, trying to figure out what's going on. The rest of the group has come into the tunnel, hopefully, you know, put the body far enough down the tunnel to make this feasible. The door slams, and then some imps attack. Now, these imps are invisible. This is the invisible theme encounter. So the invisible imps start to attack. Now, what's their MO? They like to run up and sting you with their nasty tails and then turn invisible again. So let's talk a little bit more about that. They will run up. They'll use their tail sting power, which is a reach zero power. Now, this is somewhat important to discuss. Reach zero means they have to be in the same square as you to use it.
Because these creatures are really little and they fly. And so they're invisible. They have to be in the same square as you. So I can imagine this creature coming up behind you and then attacking, stinging you in the back of the head, perhaps, while everybody else is preoccupied with this invisible body. And then you are going to have to deal with their poison.
Now, the poison is a typical 4th edition poison. That is, every turn that it's your turn, you're going to go ahead and take that 5 points of damage ongoing until you make your save. Just a reminder again, a save is just rolling 10 or higher. It's not the typical sort of poison saves we've had in the past. It's really pretty easy. But you'll also be having a -2 penalty to your will defense. That save will end both the poison effect and the will defense penalty.
What can happen then is, of course, this imp is going to become visible when it attacks you, but it is so small that it can more than likely hide in your cloak or behind your back, and the rest of your party is not going to have any idea what happened to you.
Imagine that you're standing there at the end of the row of PCs in this narrow hallway. The imp comes up from behind you, stings you. You're like, ah, you turn around, and it's hiding behind you, down by your feet, so you can't even see it, and you don't know what caused it. By the time you figure it out, it's turned invisible again, and it maybe stings you again or runs over to the next person and stings you. Depending on how big your group is, we have scaling options for how many imps there are. There will be at least 2. So from both ends of the party, these imps are stinging and turning invisible and running around amongst the group. There's this invisible dead body on the ground. It should be a pretty exciting and dynamic battle.
And it really epitomizes exactly the theme of chaos.
Exactly.
This is going to go on, and your characters are going to be very confused, and it's going to be very intense for a moment. But eventually, they will defeat the imps, and then they will move on down into the rest of the guard room, where they are greeted with more grisly sights.
The guard room is where the guards for the Temple of Art made their home, and where the key to the temple, so to speak, was housed. If you recall, the temple was sealed during this attack to prevent anything else from happening to it. The Belloquins assumed that there would be someday they'd come back, they'd unlock everything would be unfrozen in time, and they would return to their civilization. That never happened. One of the themes of Return to Northmoor is finding out why is it that the Belloquins never came back and reclaimed their civilization. And as our episodes spool out, you'll find out more about why that is.
As the characters refresh themselves, heal up from the attack with the imps, they come into this room, which they're hoping would be a safe zone, and they're greeted by another grisly scene of a couple of dead guards around a table that they had presumably either been eating at or dicing at, and they're not entirely sure what had happened here.
So these are the 2 guards that we met in our last episode who were on the path. Ideally, the characters are going to burn their bodies to let their souls move on. Especially if you have any priests or paladins or the Raven Queen, they're going to be very interested in letting these people's souls move on, and they should know that for the Belloquins, they have to be burned for that to happen.
The most important feature of this room is a very large altar to Arathis, and it will be clear that this is a large object that is made out of granite, and in the middle of it, you will find a crystalline key, much like the ones that the characters got from the Temple of Blood, shoved into the middle of it, and it appears to be empty of blood, but it was recently emptied, that all of the contents have drained into something, but there is a thick film of reserved blood left over.
And remember, all this happened a week ago, because the temple's been frozen in time for 1,000 years, so it's pretty fresh. The key is jammed into the center of the altar, right into the middle of an inlaid golden symbol of Arathis, which is this sort of gear with a sun inside it symbol. And this is what caused the temple to be sealed in the first place, is jamming this key in here and turning it. That's what invoked the seal. What broke the seal is when the Sahuagin Baron broke in through the other end of the temple and basically brought the temple back into the time stream.
So they're going to have some wondering of what this altar is, and I know when our group ran through it, we had a number of people very interested in that key and whether they could remove it, and I believe that we ended up removing it because we wanted to spare.
Yeah, it's always nice to have an extra one. And indeed, if they do press it to their wrists or whatever, it will refill with blood, assuming that they are of noble Belloquin blood, which all the PCs should be. So they'll be able to have that spare.
So they can feel free to search this room. There's going to be your typical barracks kind of room. There's bunk beds and tables and things like that.
Hidden behind one of the bunk beds is a secret door. And if they investigate the floor with appropriate perception checks, they'll be able to figure out that they can slide this bunk bed to the side. You know, they can see tracks where this has been done before and reveal a door that they can open. This door leads into the map room.
And this is a strange little room to this temple. And when they enter, they should be really filled with some wonder because before them, they see the floor isn't completely covered in a very intricate painting of a map of the city, or at least the city that once was.
So this is a trompe-l'oeil painting, which means it's a false eye, like 3D from the top-down map, but it's not actually 3D. It just looks like it's 3D. So when you walk on it, you can walk right over the map and point at different buildings. The exception to this is
this very large mound of very sharp black obsidian pebbles in the shape of the Star Temple in the middle of this map.
So the only thing that's 3D is the Star Temple itself in the center of the room. This is kind of creepy. So as they explore the beauty of this map of the Belalaquan city, this temple in the middle always kind of has a creepy vibe that draws their eye.
And if they look above them, they will see the night sky painted as it was at that time with all of the constellations as well.
Yes, it's a very accurate map. If you have anyone who's a, star-packed warlock, they might know exactly what they're seeing.
They'll also be able to use that in some fashion for navigation, and if they want to come back and explore more parts of the city, if they can get to it, they'll be able to navigate their way around.
This gives them an overview of the vastness of the city. The only buildings that we're going to say are on there, and you can add whatever you would like, is there's obviously a temple to magic, there's the Star Temple, there's a large building that appears to be the governmental building. And then there's sort of a Colosseum-y type building. All of those are laid out in and around that Star Temple in the center. There's obviously lots of other little buildings here and there, but those are the major ones that they'll probably notice.
And you can take this map of the city and really use that as your own playground. If you want your characters at some later date to explore more of the city and make your own campaign out of it, you certainly can use those places as jumping off points.
The places I described we will likely be revisiting again in Northmoor. But the rest of the city is yours to explore. Add to it. This is your chance to have a giant sub-Boggian dungeon between buildings that are locked in time. Now, not all of these buildings were important enough to get them locked in time, so some of them are truly going to be bog-soaked and nasty.
Another thing that they're going to notice within this room is a human-sized lump over in one of the far corners.
So they've explored this room, they've checked out the creepy Star Temple, they've maybe sketched down a rough map of this for themselves, and then they notice there appears to be a dead body in the shadows of the corner.
Now, they don't know if this is their mentor, if it's somebody from 1,000 years ago, if it's somebody who has crept in from another part of the temple, if it was somebody who was recently alive. There's really a sense of mystery around this body.
What it is one of the guards with a slawed tadpole in his head. It's been cooking for about a week now, and it's ready to burst.
So as they kind of approach, they're going to have a sense of foreboding and some sounds, and then an alien-like bursting from the cranium.
This is exactly the sound that they have been hearing, this sort of sucking sound as this thing tries to beat its way out of this guy's head. Again, this is fantasy, so don't get too sci-fi here, even though this is very reminiscent of Aliens, and maybe the map room is reminiscent of Raiders of the Lost Ark, two things that we all love. But focus on the fantasy aspect here. So they get close to this thing, and his head starts to maybe move on its own. So maybe they think he's alive. Again, like Kim said, maybe they think it's the mentor. They run over, and this slod tadpole bursts out of his head, maybe spraying them all with gore.
This is going to be fairly upsetting. And again, another very intense emotional moment.
Ideally, this should be something very surprising. They shouldn't expect this at all. Focus on the fact that maybe this person's only, been in here for a week. Maybe it's one of the guards from this temple and he's still alive.
And he's going to be warm still, essentially. And so they just miss their opportunity to talk with somebody who is potentially 1,000 years old.
There are two slawed tadpoles in this room, one of whom burst out of the Chaos Cultist's head, and the other one is the one that's just bursting out of this guy's head. Now, slawed tadpoles, even though they are level 5 lurkers, are not dangerous. They're just really annoying.
And really weird. They're insubstantial at times, and so you can't exactly hit them.
They are really good at biting, but they don't do a lot of damage. It's plus 10 to hit, so it's pretty good. But what happens is as soon as someone attacks them, they chaos shift. So they shift 2 squares away. And as soon as they bite, they become insubstantial until the beginning of their next turn. So it makes them extremely difficult to hit. The Slawed Tadpole's goals are to get out of here and find a nice, warm little spot where they can cook up a bunch more slawed.
So this is really your opportunity to explain the chaotic nature of the cult and really how they functioned. I mean, that's how these slawed got there in the first place.
One opportunity is to play up the fishy nature of this thing. Maybe they think it's connected to the Sahuagin somehow. Maybe it is. I'm not going to say anything. But perhaps in the future, those two things may come together. But certainly don't discourage your players from making that wonderment.
They are this slimy, little, gray, foggy, insubstantial creature that is really kind of quick.
Yeah, and as soon as they attack it, it kind of and teleports off to the side. Pretty freaky. So they're going to be chasing these things around, but eventually there one or more of them is probably going to get away. If they don't, that's okay. Believe me, there are more around. So if they catch them both, that's fine. They do have stealth +8, so it is very likely that they will be able to sneak around if need be. So that's sort of the map room. And the guard room is this battle between these weird slod, which are insubstantial and in the shadows, the imps who are stinging and biting them, and then all this weird stuff that's laying around indicating what happened to this temple on the Night of Terror. And yes, the imps did come with the Chaos Cultists and got stuck in here when the door shut.
This should really make a lot of questions more than answers for your characters. And it's a great place for you to make them write these things down and start connecting them with further parts of your adventure.
The only bodies that they will find in here are the ones we've described. But in the rest of the temple, there will be more bodies. They will eventually find Ramadal and Alanada. They will probably find some of the workers who were initially killed in the workroom when the crates burst open and the Chaos Cultists got out. All that stuff's coming up in our next episode.
So, if you have some questions and comments, please let us know on our forums. And we'd really like to hear some interactions, some questions, some comments about various parts of what we've talked about tonight. If you have questions regarding invisibility or thoughts on exactly how do you handle an invisible body and what's on him and what's not on him and when it becomes visible again.
Invisible gore and that sort of thing. If you think that there's better ways to combine these encounters, for example, one of the things that occurred to me is that with the imp's ability, the poison gives you that -2 to your will. What would be a good monster maybe to match with that? One thought would be that homunculus that we had way back that has the ability to make you attack your buddy with a will save.
That could be really kind of an interesting thing, because then you would have not only this chaos of the imps attacking, but your own buddies could be attacking you as well, and that would be a huge chaotic kind of fight.
Also, this hallway is very narrow, which is important actually for this imp fight, because the idea is they're running back and forth. It's not like the Sahuagin fight from the Temple of Blood, where having that be a long, narrow hallway was bad. This, I think, it really amps that up, but you should try it and let us know, or just give us your thoughts. The idea here is that we really want to hear what you think, and if you think there's ways for us to make this better, or you think you could do it better, we want to hear from you. The materials, as usual, are provided in the feed and on our website, and if you want to download those and run this yourself, you can. Some thoughts about running this if you're not running it as part of Return to Northmoor. The Temple of Art as a whole is something that is very tied into the Northmoor world, but it doesn't have to be. You can have this be a buried temple of any kind that's dedicated to Corlan and art and that sort of thing. And the idea is to tie the beauty and the reverence to something horrible that's happened here. We had the Chaos Cultists come in, but if you've got some generic bad guys from your campaign, or maybe not even generic ones, but the thematic main bads from your campaign, you could have them be the ones that destroyed this.
I could very easily see this being a den of thieves of sorts, because a lot of this art they can't carry around, but they kind of want to have possible possession of it at some time, so they're going to be working on figuring out how they can get it out. And so there's a lot of rooms that are concealed with concealed doors and somewhat safe to hide out in. So that could be a possibility.
And if you want to reskin this to be more of a medieval type fantasy where the walls are graystone and instead of paintings and trompe l'oeil floors and that sort of thing, you really have tapestries and statues and that sort of thing, that's an easy thing to do. The layout is described in the map, and in the show materials we do have the full map of the temple, even though we only covered a few rooms tonight. So hopefully you'll be able to figure that out, and you can reskin it in any way that you like with the art that matches your flavor.
All right, so thanks to all those who left us reviews on iTunes. We really appreciate that. It helps us to know what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong.
And to get the word out.
And also thanks for all those who have left us comments and questions in our forums.
And if you have any other questions and you don't feel like getting your words out on the forums in front of everyone, you can always email us at northmoorpodcast@gmail.com.
We also are available on Twitter, and that information is on our website.
So, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.